Good morning, I'm Michael Cathcart. You're so very welcome to Books and Arts here on RN. On the show today, Ruby Wax.
One in four people suffer from some sort of mental illness. So if it was one, two, three, four, it's you, sir, you. Yeah, with the weird teeth. And you next to him. You know who you are. Actually, that whole row isn't right. That's not good.
The comedian and writer Ruby Wax. She's headlining at the Melbourne International Comedy Festival. Her new show is called Sane New World, and it's pretty personal. We'll find out what her newfound sanity is all about. We'll also be joined by the British writer Jeff Dyer, who seems transformed by a fortnight aboard a vast US aircraft carrier. But first, we remember Betty Churcher, the much-loved art commentator and former director of the National Gallery of Australia, who died yesterday. Yes, as you may have heard, the much-loved arts commentator Betty Churcher has died aged 84. When she was appointed as the director of the Art Gallery of Western Australia, this is in the late 1980s, she was actually the first woman to run a state art gallery. And then in 1990, she became the first woman to head the National Gallery of Australia. Her passion for art began when she was just a little girl. And over the years, she shared that love of art in her books, newspaper articles and on the TV. Last year, she spoke to me about her final book, The Australian Notebooks, which is a very personal tour of her favourite artworks in Australia's public art galleries. Here's part of what she had to say.
Well, I started off life as an art student.
Right.
And when I started having babies, I put that aside and concentrated on babies. I had four boys,
right,
and they took every ounce of my energy. But the reason I draw, and I always draw, is because it slows me down. I wish people would take a little bit longer to look at a work of art. Because the John Olson, the artist, the Australian artist John Olson, said, "You shine a torch into dark corners," and that's what I love to do,
yeah,
to find something that I'd never noticed before. And you do it when you've got a pencil in your hand for some strange reason. You get into the engine room, if you like. You know, you're not just looking at the surface.
And you can also see where the artist had a problem.
Exactly.
You say, oh, yes, and he didn't quite get that arm right, did
that's
you? And
right.
You covered it with that shadow, but that's because you mucked it up.
That's true.
Do you know when it all started for you, this love of art?
Yeah, I do, actually. I've tried to avoid the Blandford Fletcher's evicted, but when I was about seven, my parents took me to the Queensland Gallery. And I thought this picture was absolutely magical. And before I started this project of going around, I had a drink with my brother. And he said, well, you've got to include Emily, evicted.
Evicted by Blanchard Fletcher.
Blanford Fletcher, yes. I said, oh, Ian, I can't. I've done it so many times. He said, no, you've got to. It's sort of where it all began. And I was in a wheelchair because I had to be on my feet all day. And I was wheeling past, looked across at Victor, and I thought, oh, I'll just go in and have a look. I wasn't going to do it. I went in, and lo and behold, my eye level in the wheelchair was where my seven-year-old eye level was. And it all suddenly became clear, the magic of paint.
I totally understand why you love this painting as a little girl, because it's a village scene set in sort of old England. There are people in top hats and girls in bonnets and so on. And it's like an illustration from a book.
It's very like an illustration. But you know what got me was those autumn leaves on the ground. The fact that oil paint could become something else.
Yeah.
And I don't know that the story really attracted me so much because I think down there, from a seven-year-old height, I couldn't see the whole story. I was just looking at those boots. I've done a drawing of what I could see.
Yeah. Well, perhaps that's why you loved it because, you know, I suppose sophisticated taste today would say, oh, this is a piece of sentimental Victoriana.
Yeah.
Because it's like, as I say, an illustration from
a kid's
book.
Well, it is that.
That's exactly what it is.
Yeah.
But it's so great of you to say, but I love it.
Yes.
I might have run the National Gallery of Australia, but actually I love this. Good on you. And the late Betty Churcher speaking to me last year. Well, Sasha Grishin joins us now to reflect on her life and legacy. Sasha is Professor of Art History at the Australian National University and a personal friend of Betty over 40 years. Good morning.
G'day.
Nice to have you here. So, I mean, let's start with the big question. What, overall, what's her contribution, do you think, to the arts in Australia?
It is a big question, and I think it probably has two parts to the answer. One, as that little interview that you just played, is she managed to broaden the base of the audience for art in Australia, possibly like no person before her. I mean, Betty had this infectious enthusiasm in everything she did, whether it be as the gallery director and introducing popular exhibitions, whether they be in these little television programs that screened on the ABC, or the number of books that she published with Melbourne University Publishing. She always wanted to sort of have a second look at the overlooked and then instill a sense of enthusiasm and interest in it. I think almost from the word go, Betty wanted more and more people to cross over to her side, to become passionate about art, to become interested in art. And that was a rare gift, because quite often in the world of gallery directors, curators, and all of those sorts of people, you're dealing with power elites and all sorts of other games, but she always had this very down-to-earth touch. Many, many times when I've walked around the galleries with her, she said, come and have a look at this. I've never seen this before. Have you ever noticed? And no, you hadn't noticed. And that sort of passion, and that lasted throughout her entire life, from when she was a child through to the end. But I think the other legacy, and she wouldn't like me to say it now because she hated tags and labels, but I think she was a sort of a feminist icon. And I say this very cautiously because there was a story that she relayed to me once. When she was a child growing up in Queensland, and Betty was born in 1931, so she was actually brought up during the Great Depression, she had an older brother, and they were both going to school. When she reached year 10, her father came and tapped her on the shoulder and said, well, that's it. And said, why? Oh, because schooling only spoils a girl.
Mm.
And that sort of stuck in her mind. And she was always bringing up that little story. A few years later, by the time she was 20, she got a scholarship and she went to London. Then she studied at the Royal School of Art there. And she proceeded to become an artist. But this idea of why should there be a different set of rules for a woman as to a man always bugged her. So Betty was the first head of a tertiary institution in Australia when she headed the Phillip Institute. She became the first female director of a state gallery when she was appointed to the Art Gallery of Western Australia. And she, of course, was the first and only director of the National Gallery of Australia in Canberra.
That story now, about her dad is sobering, isn't it? Because we forget that that's how it was. Between the wars, there would have been lots of dads all around Australia who wouldn't have understood why a girl would want to go after high school, because you get married, you're going to raise children, you can add up and subtract, you can work out how much change you've got at the shop. Why do you need to go on learning? And,
she was what a dear friend of mine would describe an axolotl. And what I mean by that is an axolotl is a fish that both breathes through the lungs and through the gills. She was an artist, and she remained an artist all her life. She could see things visually, act things visually, but she also was a literary person, very, very articulate. She went and studied at the Courtauld Institute of Art History in London as well. I mean, and she had these two sides to her, that she could see things with the inner eye of an artist, but she could also articulate what she saw. And this came across in so many of her public speeches, in her television series, the sort of enthusiasm to be able to actually see things that many people could have not have noticed and then to be able to articulate them very clearly, lucidly, and get us all on board, really interested in it.
That was her skill. But also, she was an astonishing drawer. I mean, she was just really, really good at drawing.
She was good.
That's what came through in Australian Notebooks. I was just blown away by the sheer skill with which she could wield a pencil.
Well, yes, and I mean, some people would say that when she met and married Roy Churcher, things came to a bit of a head, and someone was going to be an artist in their family, and someone was going to bring home the bacon.
Ah.
And the decision was taken that Roy was going to be the artist in the family, and she was the one that was actually going to earn a living. Now, of course, she also had four children at that stage, so she made a very conscious decision to say, well, no, Roy can only be an artist, and he was a good painter, but that's where his strength lay. I'll actually have to earn a living. And I think she published her first book in about 1973, so quite early in the piece. And that was called On Art, and that became one of the classics about teaching art and how to communicate art. So that decision was taken pretty early in sort of reverse roles. So while she hated the feminist label, but in fact, by example, she paved the way for a lot of other people to follow. Yes, it was purely on merit. She was quite an outstanding, brilliant, charismatic person. But she also had this warmth and charm about her, sort of a rather, if you can use that word, sophisticated glamour. She was a very attractive, but a very highly intelligent and reserved person. And she could actually communicate the sense of warmth. She seemed to be able to take a personal interest in what each person was doing. And even walking around the National Gallery in Canberra, she'd stop and speak to a cleaner or a security guard, discussing what their children were doing, what family life. She had that sort of concern for people, if you like, at all areas. And while she may have to, in her political life, she was a very politically savvy person, speaks to politicians and to other peoples in the corridor of power, but she also never sort of looked down at other people. It was an all-inclusive warmth about her, and that comes across very, very strongly in everything she did.
On Books and Arts, my guest this morning is Professor Sasha Grishin, and we're remembering Betty Churcher, who died just yesterday. Well, she was best known, I guess, as the head of the National Gallery of Australia, but she was so very much more than that. How did you meet her, Sasha? When did you first get to know her?
Well, actually, I met her here in Melbourne in 1982, and we just had a gathering, and I'd had encountered her before in Brisbane many years earlier, but in 82 was the first time we met. She was involved in promoting a number of artists that I was interested in, and then she disappeared to WA. And I saw her once there, but once she came to Canberra, which is in 1990, and remember, she's been in Canberra for 25 years. Yes, I did see her very, very frequently, and we became friends and colleagues. Not that we didn't disagree on things, we did, but there was always a sense of respect. And if she said something, wrote something, I would make it my business to read it and find out about it. Whether I agreed or not with it was another thing. A Canberra journalist nicknamed her as Betty Blockbuster, and she was sort of seen as the person who changed the direction of the gallery in bringing these very, very popularist blockbuster exhibitions. Probably a little bit unjust, because there was an enormous amount of political pressure on her to do precisely that. After that wonderful period under the inaugural director, Jim Mollison, the gallery needed to increase its audience participation, and Betty did precisely that in bringing a lot of popular shows. She was criticised for that.
Yeah, but that's an ongoing issue with the gallery in Canberra, because whenever I go there, you know, you walk into this beautiful collection in this striking building, and there's not many people there because you're in Canberra. So you've got this first-rate collection in a place where not many people can see them. It's great for you, Sasha, because you're at the ANU.
Yes.
But, I can't see that there is a problem with holding blockbuster exhibitions that make people think, yeah, I'm going to get on a plane and go to Canberra and have a look at that.
Precisely. I mean, I think the phenomenon of the blockbuster is an interesting one, because exactly when Betty was pioneering this in the early 90s, blockbusters were actually making a lot of money.
Yeah.
Today, they don't.
Can we say something about her taste?
very difficult to pin down her taste, because she had quite a Catholic taste. There was a group of artists in Melbourne called the Raw Group, basically sort of figurative expressionist artists. She supported them. She was interested in their work. She certainly was interested in the Melbourne Antipodean group artists. She was a great admirer of people like John Brack and Fred Williams. But she also, after a while, embraced Indigenous art. And people like Emily Kamingware became artists that she was very, very passionate about and fond of. But I think she also set an agenda to bring more recognition to neglected women artists in Australia. I think there was a quiet agenda behind some of her selections when she would speak on her little television programs about, oh, but have you seen this rare gem?
Well, thank you for coming in, Sasha, and helping us remember Betty Churcher.
A pleasure. Thank you.
Sasha Grushin is Professor of Art History at the Australian National University and a personal friend of Betty Churcher, who has just died at the age of 84. This is Books and Art. I'm Michael Cathcart, and next up we head off to sea.
Take the sea from Colombia, Mexico. I just planted up a hotter down a copperhead road. I'm not a DA's got a chopper in the air. We got screaming like I'm back over there. I learned a thing or two from Charlie, don't you know? You better stay away from Copperhead Road.
Copperhead Road by Steve Earle. Now that, as it turns out, is the sort of music you play if you're holding a barbecue on a US aircraft carrier. And my authority for this is none other than the English writer Jeff Dyer. English, although these days I gather he lives in California. Not so long ago, Jeff spent 2 weeks aboard a vast American aircraft carrier, the USS George Bush, as writer-in-resident. Who knew that you could be writer-in-residence on an aircraft carrier? What a gig. Now, Jeff, as you'll know, has written wonderfully about many subjects: jazz, schmoozing at the Venice Biennale, D.H. Lawrence. The last time we spoke, it was about the Russian filmmaker Andrei Tarkovsky. So I don't know why I'm surprised he's turned up on an American aircraft carrier. It makes perfect sense. And he joins me from a studio in Austin, Texas. Why not? Hi, Jeff.
Hi, very nice to speak with you again.
How does it come to be that a literary Englishman like your good self is on an American aircraft carrier?
Well, you have to understand one very important thing. I'm a professional writer, which means I will do anything to get out of the house. That's the sort of starting point for this. But actually, more seriously, as you were saying at the beginning, of course, the idea of being a writer in residence somewhere is not so unusual. You know, many, many colleges have writers in residence. And a more unusual residency was one that Alain de Botton had. He was writer in residence at Heathrow for a week. And he found that experience so stimulating that he had the idea of setting up a kind of foundation, the idea of which was to put writers in residence in unusual places. And he very kindly asked me if there was anywhere somewhat unusual where I would like to reside. There was, of course, a catch attached to it, which is that you had to write a book about your experience. Anyway, in a way that's not at all unusual, you know, I'd been really fascinated by kind of fighter planes and all this kind of stuff. And without very much thought at all, I realized that if I was going to go somewhere, you know, as a writer in residence, it really should be somewhere to which there was no way I would have access in my normal life. And, you know, very quickly after that, that meant it would probably be a military place. So putting that together with this long-standing fascination that I'd had with military aircraft, I said, you know, never really thinking it would happen, okay, if you can get me on board an American aircraft carrier, I would go there. And 6 months passed, and then you know, Alain called again and said, okay, you know, when do you want to go? Because it was behind the scenes, it had all been organized.
We've teed it up. So this is vast. This is a Nimitz-class aircraft carrier. These are enormous. Can you just lay out the scale of the thing for us?
You know, I really wish I could. I can't remember how big it is in terms of feet and inches. But, I mean, they're really unimaginably vast, so much so. I think the way that the sort of illustrates this the scale quite well is you've got 66 planes on this ship. So just to make room for the planes, you need to have quite a lot of space, and they've got to be able to take off. And crucially, you know, they've got to be stored. And then you've got to have room for 5,000 people. Two things, though. I mean, I was not the first journalist ever to set foot on an aircraft carrier. And one time, a journalist, I was told, had been hauled up before his editor for fiddling his taxi receipts. And of course, this is not entirely unheard of in journalism. But this time they had the journalist, you know, really, they'd caught him red-handed because he'd submitted taxi receipts for the period when he was on board the aircraft carrier. But he had this great defense. He said, yeah, I know, but, you know, have you seen the size of these things? You need to get a taxi to get around. So, yeah, they're, you know, it really is huge. But the extraordinary thing for me, I knew that it would be big. What I hadn't realized is that with all of this, all of these people on board and all of these planes, it would be absolutely sort of jammed to the rafters. They're incredibly crowded. I always remember that when I'd borrow my dad's car when I was an 18-year-old, he wouldn't let me put it back in the garage because the garage was crammed with all sorts of stuff, and the aircraft carrier psychologically felt as crowded as my dad's garage, let's put it like
as
that.
As if it had been beautifully packed.
Yeah,
by
exactly
your own,
so.
By your own dad. Yeah.
Yeah.
So the one of the great rituals of the ship is that the ship's captain gives a daily talk, which always contains the line, "Another great day at sea."
Yeah.
It's a wonderful evocation of a leader who appears to be loved.
Yes, that's quite right. I mean, just a little bit of context. We have to bear in mind that the deployment is for 7 months. So these 5,000 people are on this boat. You know, they're crammed in together for all of this time. There's lots of scope for getting sort of irritated and stuff. And, you know, it's a military aircraft. Certain disciplinary things have to be intact. But the days of Captain Bligh and the Bounty are long past. And part of the thing is to sort of keep people's spirits up. So there'd be this great thing each day when the captain would address the ship's company. And it seems something peculiarly American, the way that he could say each day that it had been another great day at sea. And although the crew viewed this with a mixture of some sort of irony and sort of wryness, at some level they also, you know, they sort of bought into it. And there was this, each day he would somehow manage to italicize a different part of the sentence, or would manage to italicize great in a different way. So in a uniquely American way, I think, although perhaps it's a positive attitude that you in Australia share. It's certainly not one that I grew up with in Britain. Each day we were in this realm of the constantly improvable upon superlative.
Hmm. Well, and Americans have this gift for optimism, don't they? I mean, they all grow up with this idea that you are the author of your own destiny. If you just believe fervently enough and strive valiantly enough, you can achieve whatever dream you wish to attain. You can, you know, you can kick any goal that you want, which is very different, I think, from the way British people think, and I think Americans and Australians too. I think Australians are a little bit more resigned about this, but it does seem to attract you in the book. It comes across the friendliness, the politeness, and the optimism of Americans does really speak to you.
Oh, you're absolutely right, because, you know, I was very specific. I said to Alain de Botton that I would like to go on I wanted to go on American aircraft carrier. Well, there's a simple logistical reason for that. You know, we don't have one. I think one is being built. But even if we'd had one, even if there'd been a British aircraft carrier, I wouldn't have wanted to go on it, because I think one of the great attractions of America, and actually of Australia, if you're British, is this freedom from the class thing. And one of the things about the British military, the class structure is so overt. Now, of course, in any military, it's going to be hierarchical. You can't run a military organization as a sort of cooperative. I mean, it's not a health food sort of shop. But there was something about the kind of, that peculiarly democratic version of the American hierarchy that I liked very much. So it was very significant for me that for part of my stay, there was the captain on the boat, but for about 5 days, he was outranked by the admiral of the whole of the whatever it was fleet. And when she came on board, so that's kind of incredible in itself. Nora Tyson was her name, I think, and she was this lovely southern accent from Tennessee or something like that, and she, it turned out, was an English major, wanted to talk to me about James, that James Joyce, the whole time. And it just seemed so inconceivable that, I mean, let's put it like this, her British equivalent, he would have been something very, very different, I think. He would have probably been, one of the more famous public schools and this kind of stuff. So, it was what I knew I was going to get on an aircraft carrier was a kind of condensation or concentration of many of the things that I'd always been attracted to about America, even though the particular America that I was going to be sort of witness to on this on this trip was actually a part of America I'd never spent time really. That is to say, the kind of the Midwest and the Bible Belt. I'd been mainly on the sort of the coastal part, on the coasts of America before this.
On RN, this is Books and Arts, and we're talking to Jeff Dyer, who's written a new book. It's called Another Great Day at Sea, and it's a wonderful book. It's about the fortnight that he spent aboard the USS George Bush, named after George Bush the Elder. Have you seen the 1980 sci-fi film The Final Countdown, which was filmed on board the first Nimitz, actually called the Nimitz, the USS Nimitz, the first aircraft carrier of this class?
Do you know, I've not seen it, but I have heard about it.
I remember it as fantastic. I mean, I saw it in 1980 when it came out. I think I reviewed it. I can't remember. I gave it the thumbs up or the thumbs down now. But in my memory, it was terrific. It's got Kirk Douglas as your Another Great Day at Sea captain. Martin Sheen is playing the Jeff Dyer character. He's some kind of analyst who's come on board as the civilian to be sort of shown around. But the twist in the story is literally a twist. They sail into a time vortex and find that they're on the eve of Pearl Harbor, and they face the moral conundrum of whether they should intervene in history, because after all, they are a ship of the American Navy, to save Pearl Harbor from those Zeros that are coming in to bomb them. So it's kind of exciting. But I watched a little bit of it last night, and it seemed kind of hokey 30 years
ago. I feel rather shortchanged that we didn't enter the time vortex. I feel that's an experience that they really could have laid on for me.
And that would have been a seller. You would have shifted a lot of units with that story, Jeff.
Yes, indeed.
So let's talk about the Steel Beach Party, which was where that Copperhead Road song was played. So this was the day you met Clinton Stonewall III, who on land had performed a feat of driving that was, I mean, just off the scale.
Yeah, so the Steel Beach Party was this day when flight operations were suspended, because I should say that every other day I was there, they were flying missions over Iraq. And so the flight deck, this place which for the rest of the time, nobody is allowed up there unless they have a very specific function to perform, because it's potentially incredibly dangerous. You've got F-18s taking off and landing. You've got all this. You've got, huge potential for things going wrong. Anyway, on this day, everybody who's not doing something else is up on the deck for a barbecue, a beer-free barbecue, I should add. But the vibe was absolutely fantastic, and I met a lot of people, including, Brian Luther, the captain, and Nora Tyson, the admiral, both wearing their shorts, which was that was a kind of different encounter with these authority figures. And yes, I also met this person with this wonderful history-packed name, Clinton Stonewall III. And he was a guy from Alabama who told me that he'd been driving along one day and he saw out of his window that somebody in the car driving along next to him, something had happened to her. She was unconscious. So he kind of did this thing of driving up alongside her and kind of nudging her car gently to the side of the road, bringing it to a stop. And then, of course, he sort of performed some sort of first aid and effectively saved her life, for which he won some incredible award. But the best thing, in a way, came even later that day, because he was promoted, I can't now remember from what to what. But he gave this incredible, rousing speech, more rousing than Henry V at Agincourt. And at the end of it, all of these guys were going up and sort of his really close friends and sort of thumping him on the back and all that kind of stuff. And I went up to him as well and sort of snivelled. That was amazing, because I really did. I had tears it was streaming down my face. It was so incredibly moving. It was really, really. For me, that was my greatest day at sea, and it was such a privilege to be part of that.
But when you say it was like Henry V, in another way it wasn't, because it wasn't Shakespearean, it wasn't grand, it wasn't, it wasn't that inflated, elevated speech. It was actually the speech of a common man. As you say, he ends up quoting Vidal Sassoon, and as you say, not Siegfried Sassoon, Vidal Sassoon, the hairdresser.
Yeah, that's right. It was all this, it was really emphasising. He started at the beginning by saying, this is not about me, it's about you, all these people. And he did this great thing of saying, whether you're flying the jets or whether you're just making the dinner, that the people, everybody has got a part to play. You've got my back, I've got yours. If I'm not looking good, you're not looking good, or the other way around. And that was the great Sassoon quote. So it was really, really, it was really fantastic.
You know what we haven't evoked is just the sheer power of those planes taking off and landing and the incredible racket. And there's a wonderful Jeff Dyer moment when you write how Pina Bausch would have loved to have gotten her hands on this scene. I thought, come on, there's no one on the plane, no one on the ship except for you who knows who Pina Bausch is.
Now
deceased German choreographer of...
But it's something that everybody who gets a chance to be on the flight deck is drawn to, because there is this very, very elaborate choreography. I mean, obviously there's radio communication between the pilots and everyone else, but you've got this whole team of these different teams of people in color coordinated vests, and they are making very, very precise signals to each other in order to coordinate this incredible unleashing of force. And then so that's that's the planes taking off. Perhaps what's even the sort of power is even more nakedly revealed when the planes are landing, because I'd assume that the planes come into land as a normal passenger plane does, as slowly as is compatible with not stalling. What I hadn't realized is that because there's a chance that the plane's hook will miss the arresting wire, the plane has to have the potential to take off and go round again. So actually, as the plane comes down, as it's coming in at the exact moment it'll hit the deck, it, instead of slowing down, it accelerates again to full power so that it can get up into the air again, which means that if the hook gets the arresting wire is... restraining this plane at exactly the moment when the plane is most determined not to be restrained. So you get this incredible contact between the chain which is determined that it will be stopped and the plane which is determined not to be stopped. It's really something, and all of that is really quite amazing when it's happening in the day. At night, when it's much more dangerous, then you see, and you've got all of these sort of flames and stuff, then it's even more, to use the word that the kids use, but to use it correctly. It really is awesome.
Jeff, we've just got a minute left, but I wonder whether you came away from this experience feeling that the world was safer or more dangerous because the USS George H.W. Bush is out there cruising the oceans.
Well, that's a colossal question you've asked. I was talking to one of the officers who was saying, everybody knows about our ability to rain steel and destruction on their heads 24 hours a day. But he was very keen to emphasize all the sort of humanitarian stuff they can do, providing disaster relief and this kind of stuff. And of course, yes, that's true. But at the end of the day, after we've given you all this humanitarian relief, if you don't like what we're doing, we can rain steel on your head 24 hours a day again. So there's certainly that aspect to it. And I was struck by the way that the mere presence of this incredible aircraft in the Arabian Gulf could be taken as a provocation, and in fact, you know, is regarded in that way by ISIS at the moment. Not that we necessarily care what they think.
Well, Jeff, it's a fantastic book. I really enjoyed reading it, really enjoyed going below decks with you, and even the fact that you managed to get your own little cabin to yourself when everyone else was packed in like sardines. There was something almost triumphal about the fact that you pulled that one off.
It was a triumph. I took on the might of the American Navy single-handedly and got a room to myself.
The skinny Englishman won the day. Good to talk to you, Jeff.
You too. Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Jeff Dyer's latest book is called Another Great Day at Sea, and in Australia it's published by Text, and it's a wonderfully smart and unexpectedly empathetic book about Jeff's fortnight on the USS George H.W. Bush. You're on Books and Arts with Michael Cathcart. Next up, a competition.
Celeste, do you prefer black to Indigenous?
Black was actually a term that we used to rally around and to gain some sort of political power.
Have either of you planned your funeral yet?
For someone who talks about it all the time, I actually haven't created a will of any sort.
What does your Twitter feed look like right now?
I always feel completely overwhelmed when I just go to that main timeline and you see everything coming through.
Join me, Patricia Carvalis, on RN Drive, weekdays at 6.
Now, if you love a writer's festival, then you might know that last week the Sydney Writers Festival, which is the largest writers' festival in Australia, launched its program, and it's packed with exciting writers and discussions. And the big news is that RN, in partnership with the festival, is giving you the opportunity to win a trip to attend. In line with this year's theme of the festival, How to Live, we're asking you in 50 words or less to name a book that's influenced how you live and why. And joining me to talk about it is Georgia Moody.
Good morning, Michael.
Hello. So what will winners receive?
They will receive return flights for two to Sydney from your nearest capital city.
But wait, there's more?
Yes. One night's accommodation and reserved seating to a number of festival sessions, including the one and only Books and Arts live broadcast on the 21st of May from the festival.
Da-da-da-da-da. All right. So all the details are on our homepage. So people have been writing in, George. What have we got?
We have got several entries from you. So let's have a look. The first entry is from Simon from New South Wales, and he says, even though Mark Haddon doesn't set out to be an expert on autism, his novel, The Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime, opened my mind and helped me understand the curious workings of the mind of my son who has autism.
There's one here. Oh, this is one that I would be on my list, actually. John Berger's Ways of Seeing was the way, this listener says, was the book that changed everything for Freya. She's from Victoria. She says, it transformed my understanding of the desire to see, be seen, and look. A teenager at the time, my narcissistic self-fascination was replaced with a questioning of the gaze. When we see, we're not just looking, we are reading and perceiving a language of images. What else have we got?
Drew has written in from Queensland, and he says the book that changed his life was The Woman's Room by Marilyn French. This young male chauvinist pig had an epiphany reading this work. It changed my whole outlook on male-female equality. My marriage failed because my wife wasn't up to the challenge. She still favoured a more traditional marriage. I'm still single.
Gosh, that's a complex narrative, Drew. Thank you for that one. Just give us one more, George. Who else has written in?
Okay. We've got Kylie from Western Australia. Her pick is Harper Lee's To Kill a Mockingbird, because we should always retain our childlike wonder with the world, and because we should walk in another's shoes for compassion, humanity, justice and fairness.
So there you go. So those are some of the listeners who've responded to this invitation to tell us a book that's influenced how you live and why. And the prize again is...
flights for two to Sydney from your nearest capital Sydney, one night's accommodation and reserved seating for a number of festival sessions. We'd love to hear from you. Keep the entries coming. Just head to the RN front page and you'll see the Sydney Writers Festival tab for all of the details.
Yes, it's all there on the homepage for RN. Thank you, Georgia Moody.
You're welcome.
Across Australia, this is Books and Arts. Next up, Ruby Wax.
Soon there'll be candles and prayers that are said, I know. Let them not weep, let them know that I'm glad to go. Death is no dream, for in death I'm caressing you. With the last breath of my soul, I'll be blessing you.
Gloomy Sunday by Billie Holiday. Well, depression and serious mental illness are not normally laughing matters, are they? But the comedian and best-selling author Ruby Wax seems to be challenging that state of affairs. In 2010, she performed a solo show called Losing It, all about her experience of clinical depression. Her latest show is called Sane New World, and it's about how we can learn to tame our minds and to laugh about it along the way. She's in Australia to perform it at the Melbourne International Comedy Festival. Ruby, as I'm sure you know, grew up in the USA. She moved to the UK in the 70s, where she's had a stellar career. Well, still has a stellar career as an actress and comedian and writer and presenter of talk shows and interview shows on the BBC. Good morning, Ruby Wax.
Hi.
So nice.
Sounds fascinating.
That does sound fascinating, yeah. I mean, when I look over your career, the people you've worked with, Alan Rickman, the people at the RSC, all your own shows on the BBC, it sounds as though you've got a life worth celebrating.
Well, I'm like a pinball machine. I hit it lucky sometimes because I honestly, I had no talent at all. In high school, they did Hello, Dolly. There were 5,000 people in the cast. I was the audience.
Yeah.
Because right. It was a large... So I got to London. I ran away from home, and I did the most pathetic audition speech and didn't get into any drama school. None. I wore a wimple because I thought, well, that's what Juliet does. And I knew she was upset in the scene. So I went, my dog is dead, my dog is dead. But I said it out loud a little bit. And then I did the scene where she knocks out her brains with Tybalt's bone. It was one of the more tragic auditions anybody done. But then I got, I'm very driven. So then I got in the Royal Shakespeare Company and was terrible in it. Alan Rickman used to hand me notes saying, don't do this for a career. While I was acting.
Yeah, but somehow you got in the door of the Royal Shakespeare Company and you're in a position to be handled notes by Alan Rickman.
Yeah, but
you must have done something
Rickman
right.
Alan Rickman was nothing either. I was playing a fern and Alan was a rock. So, you know, it was early days.
I'm a rock. You can see him there saying, I'm a rock.
I'm a rock.
So, this seems like an extraordinary question to ask someone who I've just met, but mental illness is dogging you.
No, it
when?
Isn't. Let's get it right.
Okay.
I happened to do a show a few years ago, seven, about mental illness. It was a comedy.
Right.
Because, Comic Relief put a poster of me all over London that said this, 1 in 4 people have mental illness, 1 in 5 people have dandruff. I have both. I didn't give them permission. They were raising money at a mental health charity. So then what I did was I wrote a show and pretended that was my publicity poster. So I had to write a show about depression. Well, it turned out it took off. It wasn't just about depression. I talked about, you know, how much women, you know, wives had to shut up when their husbands made, you know, £3 million a year. And then for £10,000, they could let the house and the kids go to hell. So there was lots of things in the show. It wasn't just about, you know, whining there. And that's why I wrote a show about not depression, but, you know, that state. Then I thought, I'm going to write for the 4 in 4, not just the 1 in 4 with a mental illness.
Yeah.
And then I decided I would study the mind. So I needed comedy material. Look at you. You look at me like I'm crazy.
No, I'm looking at you bewildered because I've got all this stuff in front of me about how you've had major depressive episodes.
Yeah, but you might have had herpes. It's not all the time. Maybe once every 5 years.
Right.
You go into a kind of a coma state. When I was a kid, we thought I had glandular fever. I happen to have it. It's like as insulting as saying, you know, you're an alcoholic or you've had shingles. I happen to have it. It didn't interfere with my career. I'm now the poster girl for mental illness because my show took off. And I am fighting the stigma, but it's certainly not what I do for a living.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But you have been to this place of which you speak.
Sure. So have you probably. It's 1 in 4.
Yeah.
If there's 4 people here, it might be the woman behind us. Or you know somebody.
So the show's called Sane New World.
Yeah.
Which is based on a book that you wrote called Sane New World. So what made you want to write the book?
Well, then I wanted to know about everybody's mind. Okay. Because we're not all crazy. So I enrolled, I got into Oxford. This is 2 years ago, and I studied how your mind works and how you can actually tame it. You know, so I didn't go on a weekend workshop for how to heal your inner elf. I thought, let's go to the mothership. Anyway, I studied it. I wrote a dissertation, and they let me do it as a show. And then I spruced it up with comedy. So that was how I got my master's.
I love the way you say they let me do it as a show, as if there's these people who let you do stuff.
Yeah. Well, there's a whole, they're sitting there in their bat capes and their square hats. Yeah. Like it's Hogwarts. And they said, okay, you don't have to do a I had to write something. You don't have to, you can do a show. It hadn't happened before. And they filmed it. And that's how I got my master's. Don't try it at home.
No. But you did major in psychology at university, didn't you?
Yeah, when I was, you know, 20.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then I gave it up. I thought, I'm going to go to England and try to be an actress. Appalling. But it took – it suddenly I happened to get a job in England because it was so long ago, nobody else was really – you know, they were all on tea breaks. So I got my own show, and I stayed with it for 25 years. And I thought, this is more lucrative than being a shrink.
So is it true that you've always been interested in what makes people
always
tick?
Always. That was even in high school I was interested. And when I did all my documentaries and watched celebrities, I was always trying to put the Rubik's Cube together of how their minds work.
Yeah.
And it was like a puzzle sitting in front of me.
I reckon
especially narcissism, that's really interesting.
Go on, keep talking.
No, I mean, these are people that when they go in a room, they look for who's looking at them. They're not looking at them. The people. And it's an illness that even if you experimented on a rat and gave it full attention and served it cups of tea and infantilized it, it too would have the disease of fame. Again, nobody's tried that, but if all eyes are looking at you and everybody's running with cups of tea and, you know, surrounding you with adoration, even though you, can I say suck? Even though you're bad.
Right.
Eventually you grow this part of your... You grow this part of your...
That was the weirdest radio moment I've ever had.
Did you hear it?
Yeah, I did. Oh, okay. Yeah, they all heard it.
I was whispering.
Yeah, I know.
Anyway, fame is an illness, and it's very hard to shake off once you've got it, especially when you lose it, you know, which everybody does.
Yeah.
Like when I first lost my job on TV, I'd go into the tube and I wouldn't buy a ticket, and I'd say, do you know who I am? And they'd say, the F word, pay the ticket.
Right.
Yeah. I was better on that one, wasn't I?
Yeah, you were.
Yeah.
You can say whatever you like, but if you're going to use a rude word...
I'm not going to use it. I'm done.
You can. You've got that out of your system.
Yeah.
Okay. Because we have a little procedure where I say, in a kind of regretful tone, there's some ripe language which follows.
Okay. No, this is not for adults only. This is a...
Yeah, no, that's good.
This is an PG interview.
It is. And your show, is it for adults only? Or
no,
kids
it's
enjoy
everybody, straight people, gay people, old people, embryos, everybody's in that theater. And they really laugh. And they learn about how their minds work.
My embryo is laughing. Can you imagine a mum saying that, an expectant mum? Oh, my embryo
that
is laughing.
That should be my reviews. Yeah, my embryo laughed.
Yeah, my embryo laughed. That'll look good. This is Books and Arts. We're talking to Ruby Wax, who's in Australia.
How am I doing?
You're doing pretty good, yeah. Yeah, no, I'd give you a job. I'd let you play a rock or whatever it was, a fern alongside
Fern, Alan, get it right.
A fern.
Yeah.
I was listening.
Fern. There were two ferns. Two.
Whatever happened
Juliet Stevenson was fern number two.
No, you're
swear to
making
God,
this up.
Juliet was fern number two.
Was she?
Yep.
Was she as good as you?
No.
No.
And she took my career.
You were robbed.
I was robbed of my career because she upstaged me.
Yeah. She just wiggled she wiggled her leaves in a way that... caught the attention of Alan Rickman, perhaps. Who knows? So you presented the show already in London, so we know how it works.
Yeah, I mean, I've taken it to America and London, and it's pretty popular. So it does work.
So the audience gets involved. What happens?
No, I do the show. I sort of do a mental striptease for them because I'm very honest.
Yeah.
And I take them on a journey of why they think the way they think. You know, and some of it's fact, some of it I'm making up. But why certain things work 100,000 years ago for us, perfectly made, but now our mind is still caveman.
Such as,
we get those thoughts in our head like I could have, I shouldn't, I screwed up. That was really necessary way, way back in the bush because we had to be vigilant. Because if you were whistling a happy tune, you'd find yourself eaten. So now we're always vigilant So we're, you know, full of adrenaline and cortisol because our brain can't tell if there's danger behind us or something is happening 20,000 miles away. And with the news, I don't even watch it. It permeates into our flesh. So we're completely hysterical because a whale has been beached in Malawi or, you know, there's a 3.6 earthquake in boom, boom, boom. You know, yeah. All of this news is banging, banging. So we are on high alarm the whole time. This is why they say by 2020 it's going to be stress that wipes us out. Right. They'll have a cure for everything else. But we are – forget about mental illness. People are burning out at the rate of knots and finding – even people who have nothing to do are under the pressure of people going busy. When did that start? People used to say, have a nice day, busy, and they look at you with expectation. And you go, yes, so busy, I've had a heart attack, I'm on life support. Then they go, that's fantastic.
Right. And does the audience themselves get involved in the show?
No, they know what I'm talking about. And then there's an interval, and after the interval, I invite them in for a discussion. And let me just say, nobody shuts up.
Right.
Because it's nobody has a place to talk about it.
So and they come on stage, do
no,
they?
No, they talk in the audience.
Okay.
They talk amongst themselves.
Oh.
You know, like, I don't know where to go for this. Somebody will say, I can tell you, and it's like a buddy system they meet after
But you mean
show.
Like you got microphones, do you hand it around?
I don't. They Other people do.
Yeah,
it's
but
like
we're
a
hearing.
Dating service for the psyche.
Okay.
Yeah, they listen to each other, yeah.
So
the whole
So the performance moves off stage and into the auditorium.
No. Oh, God. You have a radio show. Imagine, I'm on stage, I do a show, I take a curtain call.
Yeah.
I say, after 20 minutes, go drink, but maybe don't come back in here drunk. And then we'll have a discussion. I stay on stage and people run
right.
with microphones.
I gotcha.
But I don't always answer the questions, but they do sometimes, too. They come up with their problems and their answers. It's hilarious sometimes, sad. It's what human beings should do. You know, we don't have a place to meet. There's no community.
No,
and so in that moment, that theater is it's sensational.
Sometimes I wonder whether it's a little sad that people go to a therapist. Do you think, isn't that something you could have discussed with a friend? I'm not trying to...
No. You could have discussed it at church. You could have discussed it with your community. You could have discussed it, you know, in the old days with grandma,
yeah.
you know, some old wise woman. Good luck finding anywhere to discuss anything.
Yeah.
So it now has to be my show.
Yeah. And so it's called Say New World.
Like the book.
It's on the Melbourne International Comedy Festival.
Yeah. And the book is I might as well push it.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
I can't stop you.
No.
You're live.
There's a book. There's a
book.
Show.
There's a show.
There's a dissertation.
And Ruby's touring after she's in Melbourne. She goes to Canberra, Adelaide, the Gold Coast, and to Sydney. You'll find details on our website.
Oh, there you go.
There you go.
Now you're nice to me.
You've been
just insulting from the beginning
that
of this.
Concludes the program for today.
Are you this cruel to everybody?
Yeah, I am. I'm horrible. Nellie Melba.
You should come to my show. I could help you.
Could you? Thank you so much. Shall I read this out about Dame Nellie Melba's auction?
Sure.
Okay.
Talk about somebody else.
Dame Nellie Melba's family had reason to pop some champagne corks last night, it says on this script. Last week on Books and Arts, you heard Gary Singer at Sotheby's Australia talk about the auction of some of the diva's treasures. There's jewellery and art and decorative objects. You remember all these. Well, Sotheby's managed to sell them all, 162 items last night, and they made $2 million for the family. And in 1922, Melba scored a gold paperweight depicting Australian flora and fauna. I don't know what. Ruby Wax, don't make that noise on my radio show. She performed in Geelong. She got given this thing, and it's quite lovely, but someone has paid $134,000 for it, three times the estimate. That's a very heavy paper, mate.
I mean, have an earring.
Yep.
I'm willing to sell it.
You're
for
willing
anything.
To sell
anything.
We'll get the guy from Sotheby's on. He can give us a valuation. Or you can write in if you'd like to buy Ruby's earring.
I lost the other one.
We need to stop the program now because it's getting out of hand. I'm Michael Cathcart. Do join me again tomorrow when we'll be... What are we doing tomorrow? Oh, yes, we're going to look at the question of what is it that defined island music? Is it about being contained by the sea? Or maybe it's about sitting on the island and looking out towards the ocean and letting the influences wash in with the tide. Musicians.
I wish I worked here.
Musician from the islands of Cape Breton and the Faroe Islands are in Australia for the National Folk Festival.
Oh.
Yes, where Ruby Wax is not allowed to sing or participate even as a fern. So they will join us to explain their particular cultures and traditions and contemplate what those shorelines mean for music.
Oh, I'm there.
This is the hardest read I've ever done in my whole time on radio.
Is this comedy?
Yeah, well, it is now. It was a serious art show, but it's completely falling apart. part. Look, Earshot's coming up next. It's all about music, whether it's just sound that you hear or whether the other senses are involved, whether Ruby Wax is there mucking it all up for you.
That made Michael... no sense what you just said.
Yes. I'm Michael Cathcart. Do have an excellent day. We'll have a Ruby Wax show, free show tomorrow. No Ruby Wax on the show tomorrow. Good on you. Do have a great day. I'm Michael Cathcart. This is RN. Bye-bye.
We don't love our politicians in Britain at the moment. The whole lot of them can go to hell as far as a lot of people are concerned.
The Brits are off to the polls next month. For Prime Minister David Cameron, the stakes are high.
I think the most important election in a generation.
But the outcome is hard to predict, with voters turning away from the two major parties and the rise of new political forces. Join me, Tom Switzer, as we check in on the British election campaign on Between the Lines. Thursday night at 7:30 here on RN.